rethinking of this, and it is real new territory for the United States, because we're not going to be able, apparently, to say, do this, and the other people are going to say yes. The Chinese have said, no, we're not going to do that. And so I think that this is really new territory, and I don't see with the president's Obama administration, but actually almost all the Biden people are old Obama folks,
right.
Don't see any kind of basic rethinking going on here.
Well, what do you think, George? How likely are we to see a military conflict between these two powers?
Well, one would like to think that it's unlikely. However, I tend to think that the Biden people will probably emphasize the military aspect of the conflict with China more than the economic aspects. I mean, I don't think they're as preoccupied with the economic questions as the Trump administration was. I mean, that really was an important ingredient of Trumpism, which was to use tariffs in order to essentially build up America's industrial base at home. That was the goal of Trump. That isn't really the goal of the Biden people. I don't think they think in those terms. And it's certainly, given the corporate and financial interests that are very close to the Biden people, I don't think that they're going to pursue that goal with anything like the vigor that the Trump people did. That's why I tend to think that the military aspect is likely to be emphasized. So particularly if they get into a whole to do with China in the South China Sea and the East China Sea, and then they get into the whole human rights thing with the Uyghurs, and if they start trying to build up a kind of an Asian version of NATO, which I think they may well like to do, I think that's going to cause a lot of problems with China. I mean, China really isn't going to tolerate any kind of a variant of NATO on the Asian continent.
Okay. Well, what I'm understanding from both of you is basically Beijing and Washington are actually going to have a lot of issues with each other coming up the next few years. And with that brings us to the end of this debate. I appreciate both of you being with us, out of Madison, Emeritus Professor from the University of Wisconsin, Frank Inspach, and out of Budapest, Senior Research Fellow, Global Policy Institute, George Sabute. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing off for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, he is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. La hawla wa la quwwata illa billah al-Aliyy al-Azim. الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد
وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين عجل الله تعالى فرجه الشريف وجعلنا من أعوانه وأنصاره وشيعته. The last point we've been discussing was that community of Ahlul Bayt is a community which is built around the truth and is trying to be always at the service of truth. And we want to continue this and address another important quality, and that is unity. Interestingly, in the Quran you find a close link between being truthful and united. It is only truth that can unite a community, because truth is always one. If you all try to serve the truth, there is no way to be divided, there is no way to fight. As soon as we forget the truth, when we start thinking about our own interest, our own ego, then divisions start and there is no end. Therefore, now I want to move on to the relation that should exist between the members of the community of Ahlul Bayt. So a community which is truthful and therefore united, the members are in maximum friendship and unity with each other. We have many, many hadiths about the love, about the support that should be between the brothers and sisters in faith, between mu'mineen, between the lovers of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. I only mention few that I have chosen, and they're all from Al-Kafi. Once Mu'alla ibn Khunais asked Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, what are the rights that believers have over each other? What rights they have? Is it just enough that we don't harm each other, we don't annoy each other? Is it enough? No. Imam said, every mu'min, every believer has 7 rights. And when you see, some of them are indeed one category under which there are several. لَهُ سَبْعُ حُقُوقٍ وَاجِبَاتٍ. These are necessary. These are not, you know, just recommended. These are the things that you have to observe. مَا مِنْهُنَّ حَقٌ إِلَّا وَهُوَ عَلَيْهِ وَاجِبٌ. All these are necessary. إِنْ زَيَّعَ مِنْهَا شَيْئًا خَرَجَ مِنْ وِلَايَةِ اللَّهِ وَتَاعَتِهِ. If you don't observe these rights, then you have gone out of Allah's wilayah, out of Allah's obedience. وَلَمْ يَكُنْ لِلَّهِ فِيهِمْ نَصِيبٌ. Allah has nothing to do with this person. قُلْتُ لَهُ جُعُلْتُ فِدَاكَ مَا هِيَ. What are those rights? You know, it seems that we are missing a lot. Imam said, Ya Mu'alla, inni alayka shafiq, akhafu an tudayya wa la tahfaz. Imam said, I am worried that I may say you this and then you don't keep it. Then you will be responsible. Because if Imam had not informed him, and then there was no way for him to knowing. You know, sometimes something is there, you don't go to learn. This is not an excuse. You know, sometimes people say, no, we don't go to majalis, we don't listen with sit with ulama, because we learn things, then we become responsible. This is not a good excuse. Allah on the day of judgment asked people, Halla amelt, why you didn't practice? He said, I didn't know. Then Allah says, Halla ta'allamt, why you didn't learn? So you have 2 problems. You didn't know and you didn't learn. But when Imam doesn't say anything, means this person has no access, then he is not responsible. So Imam said, I'm worried that you may not be able to keep it. Then he said, قُلْتُ لَهُ لَا قُوَّةَ إِلَّا بِاللَّهِ. Such a nice answer. He didn't say, I am going to do this. He said, power for implementation comes from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Inshallah, I'm going to do it. So shall I now say or not? Of course, if I don't say, it doesn't make any difference, because it's there already. So, I say it. But لَا قُوَّةَ إِلَّا بِاللَّهِ. Imam said, أَيْسَرُ حَقٍ مِنْهَا. The least, the slightest, the smallest right is this. أَن تُحِبَّ لَهُ مَا تُحِبَّ لِنَفْسِكَ وَتَكْرَهُ لَهُ مَا تَكْرَهُ لِنَفْسِكَ. In many moral systems, this is the maximum they say. But Imam Sadiq says, this is the least. To wish for your brother what you wish for yourself, and to dislike for him what you dislike for yourself. This is the minimum. But if we observe only this minimum, our life becomes heaven. Anything you don't want for yourself, don't want for anyone else.
Anything you want for yourself? What do you want for your sister? Just give it to your wife. What do you want for your brother? Give it to your husband. Do you want your children to be happy? So be kind to your son-in-law, daughter-in-law. Everything that you want respect for your mother, show respect to your mother-in-law. If we observe this thing, everything becomes okay.
Oh, what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
وَالْحَقُّ الثَّانِي, the second right, أَنْ تَجْتَنِبَ سَخَطَهُ وَتَتَّبِعَ مَرْضَاتَهُ وَتُطِيعَ أَمْرَهُ. Avoid making your brother and sister Iman angry, unhappy, annoying. وَتُطِيعُ أَمْرَهُ. Obey your brother and sister. If your brother and sister ask you something, obey. Mu'mineen have such a right over each other that they can command. Inshallah, I will talk one night about Amr bi Ma'ruf. Amr cannot come without authority. Allah has given us authority over each other. I have authority over you, you have authority over me. So I have right of obedience, you have also right of obedience. Because we all have to be at the service of truth. Whoever understood the truth should tell others, and others have to listen. Then Imam said, وَالْحَقُّ الثَّالِثِ. So after wishing for him what you want for yourself, then not making him angry, not annoying him, and listening to him, the third right, أَنْ تُعِينَهُ, to help him. بِنَّفْسِكَ وَمَالِكَ وَاللِّسَانِكَ وَيَدِكَ وَرِجْلِكَ. Help your brothers and sisters with your life, nafs. Sometimes it's not a matter of money. I have to give my blood. I have to work hard. I have to travel. I have to give energy. I have even maybe to exhaust myself to look after my brothers and sisters. Your money, your tongue. Sometimes with your tongue you can solve a problem. He needs, you know, a kind of reference. He needs, you know, someone to interfere and solve the problem that he has with someone else. He needs advice. He needs consultation. With your hand, with your foot, sometimes you need to go with him somewhere. He says, you know, I want to go, for example, for a job, or I want to go for marriage proposal. Please come with me. You should be available. وَالْحَقُّ الرَّابِعُ أن تكون عينه ودليله ومرآته. You should be like his eyes. When you are the eye for each other, then whatever you understand, whatever you see, honestly, sincerely, you tell your brother. You should be his guide. You should be his mirror. Mu'min should be a mirror for another mu'min. You see in mu'min whatever you need to know about yourself. He's honest. He tells you, no, this is your problem, or this is your strong point. Then you learn and you improve yourself. وَالْحَقُّ الْخَامِسِ, the fifth. أَلَّا تَشْبَعَ وَيَجُوعَ. You must never be full and he is hungry. You must never be drinking and he is thirsty. لَا تَرْوِي وَيَذْمَعَ. لا تلبس ويعرى. You are full dressed, he has nothing to put on. It's not possible. والحق السادس, the sixth. أن يكون لك خادم وليس لأخيك خادم. Sometimes you have a servant. Your brother has no servant. فواجب أن تبعث خادمك فيغسل ثيابه ويصنع طعامه ويمهد فراشه. You have some employee, some staff, you know, someone to help you. He doesn't have anyone. So you send your servant, you know, look after him as well. Of course, without putting too much on your servant. Because you don't want to do zulm to serve someone. But your servant has free time. You have many servants sent to help. Or you have children, you know, look after this old man, this old lady. This is not of help. Their children are not here. If everyone thinks like this, then no one will be left out. No one would be without support and help. الحق السابع the seventh is أن تبر قسمه. When he says, you know, something, and he says, you know, by Allah, you accept. تجيب دعوته. When he invites you, you accept. وتعود مريضا. If he becomes ill, or he has in family someone who is ill, you go and visit. Visiting mu'minin is a right. وتشهد جنازته. And if he dies, you attend the funeral. وَإِذَا عَلِمْتَ لَهُ أَنَّ لَهُ حَاجَةً تُبَادِرُهُ إِلَىٰ قَضَائِهَا وَلَا تُلْجِئْهُ أَنْ يَسْأَلَكَهَا. If you know your brother or sister in Iman has a haja, has a need, don't wait till he or she is forced to come and ask you. If you know he has haja before he loses his honor by asking you, you go and offer. If I know someone is in need of help, I shouldn't wait till he comes to me. You should offer. Then Imam Sadiq said something very, very important. Very, very important. فَإِذَا فَعَلْتَ ذَلِكَ. If you do all these things, وَصَلْتَ وِلَايَتَكَ بِوِلَايَتِهِ وَوِلَايَتَهُ بِوِلَايَتِكَ. If you do all these things, now you can say that you have immersed in the ocean of wilaya. Your wilaya is connected to your, his wilaya to your wilaya, and vice versa. Because, as I have been saying, you know, for several years, I don't know if you have heard my lecture about nature, collective nature of wilaya. Wilaya is not relation of one person with Imam. Wilaya is the relation of all mu'mineen with each other and Imam. Wilaya is not something that every person can establish with Imam regardless of other mu'mineen. Wilaya is something that binds all of us together with Imam. Wilaya is belonging to the community of Imam. If you have millions of drops, this is not enough. When these drops are connected and you have the ocean, then that ocean is wilaya. Not just having, you know, individuals. So Imam said, by doing these things for your brothers and sisters, your drop and his drop are connected. Your wilaya then is completed. And if we do all the same thing, then we can claim that we are the community of Ahlul Bayt alayhim assalam. Wa akhiru da'wana an alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen.
That was The Characters of Shia Community by Hujjatul Islam Dr. Shomali in the program The Spiritual Message of Islam.
My ummah, he will say, Rasulullah on that day, even though we've strayed from him and his way. My brothers, my sisters in Islam, let's struggle, work and pray. If we are to bring back the glory of his way.
The coronavirus pandemic has become an endless nightmare for much of the world. Despite the development and distribution of a range of new vaccines, many countries are still struggling to battle the deadly waves of the highly transmissible disease. As the world steps up efforts to contain the deadly virus, new variants are rapidly replacing older versions, making the situation even more frightening. Many thousands of people lose their lives every day worldwide, despite restrictive measures that have paralyzed economies. The pandemic could get much worse before it gets better. The world is undoubtedly eager to find out how the whole thing began so that future risks can be minimized. The origin of COVID-19 has been a major bone of contention, especially between the world's worst coronavirus-hit country, the United States, and China, where the deadly virus was first detected in December 2019. The two sides have exchanged barbs over the origin of the crisis. Now all eyes are focused on a fact-finding mission on the origins of the pandemic. A team of scientists from the World Health Organization is right now in the Chinese city of Wuhan, trying to find out the origins of the outbreak. The WHO says its fact-finding mission in Wuhan is purely scientific, but the probe is facing a political minefield. The World Health Organization team will carry out on-the-ground investigations into the source of the new coronavirus. The WHO scientists will visit different places in Wuhan and talk to people and officials. The WHO says all hypotheses are on the table during the probe. The WHO team is expected to inspect a seafood market in Wuhan, which was linked to many of the first COVID-19 cases in December 2019. The scientists will also visit hospitals that treat coronavirus patients in the city. But how much will the team of investigators be able to uncover? The WHO experts face a tough task as the city has been repeatedly disinfected. The investigation is ongoing in Wuhan, but there have been cautions against expecting any breakthroughs soon. It could take years before any firm conclusions can be reached. What's making the WHO mission even tougher is the fact that it has been highly politicized. Several countries, particularly the United States, accuse the Chinese government of hiding the outbreak's severity during its early stages. The administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump kept criticizing China for alleged failures in containing the outbreak and refusing to tell the truth. The WHO itself was branded by Trump as a, quote, puppet of China. The Chinese government has dismissed Western allegations, saying the virus might have begun outside of China. Trump is now gone, but the White House is keeping up pressure on Beijing. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki expressed concern this week about what she called misinformation coming out of China. Beijing has warned against any negative speculation and politicized interpretation of the fact-finding mission. Will the WHO scientists be able to carry out their investigation properly despite all the political pressure?
Obviously, the scientific medical investigation may help for future prevention or development of science in terms of understanding how viruses change and how the pandemic started and how the new virus originated. Obviously, among scientists, or at least the majority of scientists, believe what happened is a natural mutation of the virus.
Observers believe that the scientists should be allowed to complete their work independently because the results could prove vital for the future of mankind.
What was planned by the Dutch government as a system to prevent the rapid spread of the COVID-19 virus in the Netherlands has turned sour, as it seems that the curfew imposed has been met with staunch opposition, with four nights of rioting taking place across the country, causing shops to be looted, infrastructure to be damaged, and police having to react to contain the disturbance. With police facing rioters on the front line, water cannons, CS gas, and other forms of police force have had to be deployed, resulting in hundreds of arrests being made and fines allocated to those who break the curfew rules. Yet it seems after four nights of violence involving a crowd formed by a majority of youths, the police have managed to take hold of the situation as protests have died down as the consequences of the actions of the rioters are being met with a tough stance by the police and the government. In fact, the reaction by the Dutch government is one of anger as it claims that all damage will be paid for by those responsible. A tough task to apply, but something that the government of Mark Rutte is keen to go through with, as echoed by the Dutch finance minister, who has labelled the rioters as scum. Many of the protests and rioters are complaining about the measures being taken by the Dutch government when it comes to containing and dealing with the virus, claiming a curfew still does not eradicate the virus. But many in the Netherlands do not agree with the protests, stating that only a small minority of people are causing so much trouble.
Well, we're very sorry about it. It's just really unfortunate, actually. I have a feeling that most of these people, not all of them, some are genuine protesters against corona rules, right? But most of them are just people who usually attend football matches and just are looking for rioting, etc. And that's really unfortunate. I mean, that's just not what all of the Netherlands is. I mean, this is just like 0.1% of population, or maybe 0.01% of population. It's very unfortunate that it gets such a lot of international attention.
With a country very much like the rest of Europe, impatient to get the vaccines rolled out, hence allowing life to return to some kind of normality, it remains to be seen what will happen until then. However, deep in the mix of the protests, yet still visible enough to be seen, it seems that the protests and riots are a stage for another form of demonstration in the Netherlands, one that may yet again rise its ugly head in the near future. Many countries across the world have seen the effects of the pandemic affect their social well-being, causing many people to reach boiling point, as over 12 months of hardship has seen the world change the way it performs, even the most benign of duties. Yet worryingly, in the Netherlands, pockets of protests have included political groups, which most concerning of all, contain far-right movements, with evidence suggesting that the Dutch branch of the German-born Pegida ideology has been counted amongst the protesters. The Netherlands has a strong far-right influence in its political parties, and this has been reflected by some far-right politicians calling on the Dutch military to step in and protect the streets of the country against the rioters. Something that suggests the current plan to control the situation by the police may just not be enough, in spite of a calmer last day or two. But the Netherlands, as we know, has a strong anti-immigrant and in particular anti-Muslim following, inspired by the likes of far-right leader Geert Wilders, who in his past rhetoric has made his feelings very clear about certain communities living in the country.
Look at the Islamization of our country. If a Dutch person driving in a car drives 5 miles too fast, he will be fined within a minute. Whereas the Moroccan scum in Holland, and once again, not all are scum, but there is a lot of Moroccan scum in Holland who makes the streets unsafe. Mostly young people. And they are not taken seriously. We are making them and the people unsafe, and that should change.
With far-right groups such as Pediger now emerging in the shadows of the protests, could this openly public sentiment fall into the hands of far-right leaders, such as Geert Wilders, who may use the surge in feelings to fuel his campaign to bring the far-right up another notch on the political spectrum, especially as the Dutch are due to face an upcoming election following the resignation of current Prime Minister Mark Rutte, following a welfare payment scandal. There's no doubt that far-right groups across Europe are still very much in place, and although the COVID-19 virus has played its part on diverting attention away from politics for now, could the example seen in the Dutch protests and riots be the catalyst for other far-right groups in Europe to jump on the bandwagon and politicise the virus to their own benefits?
January 26th is remembered by many Australians as a national day, with many celebrating the occasion with pop and show to mark the anniversary of the 1788 arrival of a group of British ships called the First Fleet at Port Jackson in New South Wales and the raising of the British flag at Sydney Cove by Arthur Phillip. The part of the celebrations was hoisting an Australian flag over Sydney's Opera House and displaying the word Austay on the sky over the Sydney Harbour. But the celebrations of the origins of a modern nation are a time of mourning for Indigenous Australians who have endured discriminations despite inhabiting the land for centuries. They view the arrival of British settlers 200 years ago as the beginning of pain and suffering. They even brand the Australia Day as Invasions Day. That's why thousands of people, mainly Indigenous, defied coronavirus restrictions on Tuesday and took to the streets in several cities to highlight their plight. Some protesters chanted a slogan such as "Sovereignty was never ceded" and "No justice, no peace," while others held up placards reading "Not a day to celebrate" and "Black lives matter."
It's very important because the issues that we're facing here in Australia are not going to go away overnight. So until we start getting justice and start seeing change in this country, we will not stop. This will be continuous. We no longer call it Australia Day, it is now Invasion Day. Always was and always will be Invasion Day.
But why do Indigenous Australians view this auspicious day as Invasion Day?
There's a much wider recognition these days of the 26th of January as an Invasion Day or a Survival Day, because at least for the last generation or so, younger people have learnt that the colonisation of this country was not simply a matter of settlement, it was a matter of brutal dispossession, it was a matter of genocide, it was a matter of trying to obliterate the culture of Indigenous people here. And at least for the last 30 or so years, there's been a recognition every year and some greater recognition in schools and universities of that sort of history. So there is now, as a result, this very strong tension between the ongoing celebration of colonisation called Australia Day and the recognition of Survival or Invasion Day, which is an important educative influence over younger people in this country.
Australia Day, which was formally declared a national holiday only in 1994, has increasingly heightened heated debates in recent years. The occasion is staunchly defended by right-wing commentators and retains strong support from the country's conservative government. Prime Minister Scott Morrison believes history changed forever in 1788 and that there was no escaping or cancelling that fact. He says for the better and worse, it was the moment where the journey to modern Australia began. But federal opposition leader Anthony Albanese has a totally different reading of the whole historical journey. This is Australia Day, is the one Australians need to acknowledge that it has been a very difficult day for the First Nations people.
In the first instance, it's important for us to recognise our own history and the consequences of our own history and the fallout of that colonisation and dispossession and the way in which the non-Aboriginal communities benefited from that and still benefit from that and the ongoing enormous social advantage against Indigenous people in this country, which far outweighs that of any other community. So if we don't understand our own history, we can't have a resolution of contemporary problems. Secondly, because Australia is involved in a lot of adventures, a lot of neocolonial adventures in other countries, we can't recognise the problems of that and the problems of our own intervention in other countries unless we understand our own history and the colonisation of our own history.
Australia's Aboriginals currently represent around 3% of the country's population, but the most disadvantaged lot of the society. They are also said to be largely excluded in their limited capacity to participate in the decision-making or even control their own and mainstream social and cultural environment. From forcible separation of children from their families to their being displaced from their land, limited education, and inadequate employment, discrimination has been widely recorded by advocacy groups. But how has the Australian Indigenous population been marginalised even to the present day?
Well, there's been enormous disadvantage. It occurs across the board. For example, Aboriginal people in prison are something like 14 to 15 times overrepresented. In education, there's been enormous disadvantage. In health, there's terrible disadvantage. As I said, there's no other ethnic group or community that is nearly as disadvantaged as Aboriginal people, despite the fact that large amounts of money have been spent on particular programs, but they haven't achieved success because there's a very deep cultural alienation, for example, from the institutions and the educational institutions of Australia.
All in all, what needs to be done is for the Australian government to put an end to the misery of the Indigenous people and take steps to make it not look like they're from another planet.
It's very rare that a former leader publicly criticizes or provides advice to his or her successor, and is often something that protocol frowns upon when it's done. However, this has not stopped the former Labour Chancellor and Prime Minister Gordon Brown from doing so, leaving Boris Johnson red-faced in the process. So intense has the criticism been that Gordon Brown has stated that Britain is becoming a failed state, not only through the poor mishandling of various crises by the British government, but also because of the ever-widening and deepening divisions within the British socio-political system. It seems that Brown has placed the blame squarely at the feet of Boris Johnson, suggesting that the Prime Minister is so alienated from the reality in which British people are living that he has lost scope of how British feel on a variety of issues and everyday problems. One of the main reasons for the disparity is the divide between the Conservative Party and the people, a division that's traditionally seen different classes voting for different parties in the UK, with the working class commonly leaning towards Labour and the upper middle class swinging towards the Tories, hence leading to a lack of communication between the ruling party and the majority of people in Britain. One such example of just how divided the UK are as a population is the opinion on Brexit. With such a slim divide between those wishing to leave the EU and remain, the difference of opinion of people across the whole of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and the north of Ireland is already fractured, without raising the notion of nationalism and separatism into the equation. So when the element of nationalism is introduced into the argument, for example, in the case of Scotland, is former Prime Minister Gordon Brown right when he says that the UK is on the verge of becoming a failed state? And if so, just how serious is the problem?
It's obvious that the present system isn't working. When you have one of the constituent nations, Scotland and the other, completely at odds with the capital and the sort of the economic core of the country, then it obviously the system is not working. A political system has not got just to, hasn't just to represent a numerical majority. It has to represent all sectors of society and all regions of a country. And this current system is obviously failing to do so.
Back in 2014, the majority of Scots rejected the idea of having an independent Scotland, for the country was benefiting from EU budgets allocated to its agriculture, economy, and education sectors. However, now that Britain has left the EU, Scots see themselves empty-handed and are highly considering rejoining the EU once again. Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon has repeatedly stated that she would push for a second referendum if her party wins a majority in May elections. Sturgeon has insisted on her country's political independence by stating that Westminster's consent to the move is not their priority, for it's for the people of Scotland to choose, and not the lawmakers in Westminster. Latest poll shows that nearly half of the people in Scotland are now in favour of an independent country, a figure that's likely to increase even more as Scots see less benefits flow into their country, and Scottish nationalism is significantly on the rise, hence putting the Scottish people much closer to the option of voting for such a move.
Well, yes, because the last referendum they had was under completely different circumstances. Britain was part of the European Union. Scotland and the Scots were very happy Europeans, and they liked it that way. When Britain left the European Union, they were left, defenceless and without allies in the face of an overweening London capital. So, yeah, they're entitled to ask for it. Whether they should get it or not, is another story. Once the time comes, vote for independence.
Some of the problems that Britain is struggling with in its post-Brexit era and the widening political and social inequality have encouraged other countries within the UK to consider leaving, for they believe that they're better off on their own. Current polls indicate that over half the people of the north of Ireland welcome the idea of holding a referendum on a united Ireland. Also in Wales, people are starting to back the idea of holding a referendum on independence, spelling the inevitable breakup of the United Kingdom in the process. Can Boris Johnson's Conservative government, therefore, reunite a divided Britain? Or has the pendulum swung too far past the tipping point, taking Britain towards a collapsed failed state full of internal division?
سبز و سپید نمانم من زری خاکه وطنم من
This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
In the limelight.
A government agency known as the Congressional Watchdog has issued a new report recently shedding more light on the Trump administration's failed response to the raging coronavirus pandemic. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jessica Corbett Ryder. This article is published under the heading, New Government Report Details How Trump Failed COVID-19 Response Across the Board. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. A U.S. government agency known as the Congressional Watchdog has issued a new report recently shedding more light on the Trump administration's failed response to the raging coronavirus pandemic. Over 430,000 Americans had died from COVID-19 by Thursday, January 28, and the country's hospitalizations, though falling, have still topped 100,000 every day this month. The report released on Thursday, January 28, by the Government Accountability Office, GAO, entitled COVID-19, Critical Vaccine Distribution, Supply Chain, Program Integrity, and Other Challenges Require Focused Federal Attention, is the fifth agency analysis of the March 2020 Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security CARES Act. The findings alarmed key lawmakers, including Representative James E. Clyburn, House Majority Whip, and chairman of the Select Subcommittee on the Coronavirus Crisis. As Clyburn put it, today's alarming report from the Government Accountability Office provides further confirmation of what the Select Subcommittee's investigations have made clear. The previous administration's coronavirus response failed across the board, exacerbating the pandemic's toll of death, disease, and economic harm. The report illustrates how the response was ineffective, lacking a comprehensive testing strategy, and failing to address medical supply shortages, inefficient, bungling the initial stages of vaccine distribution, and equitable, failing to protect workers and leaving federal relief programs vulnerable to significant risk of fraudulent activities, Clyburn said in a statement. Perhaps most disturbingly, the Majority Whip added, today's report revealed that even after GAO made 27 different recommendations aimed at improving the response, the Trump administration failed to implement them. That means only 4 of 31 GAO recommendations have been implemented. GAO remains deeply troubled that agencies have not acted on recommendations to more fully address critical gaps in the medical supply chain, the report says. While GAO recognizes federal agencies continue to take some steps, GAO underscores the importance of developing a well-formulated plan to address critical gaps for the remainder of the pandemic, especially in the light of the recent surge in cases. The former U.S. administration's refusal to act on the agency's recommendations also drew criticism from Benny G. Thompson, chairman of the House Committee on Homeland Security, who said that this report confirms what we already knew. The Trump administration failed to take any meaningful action to improve the federal response to the COVID-19 pandemic during its final month. It's inaction to address critical weaknesses that GAO previously identified, including developing clear and comprehensive plans for testing and vaccine distribution, likely cost lives and created an even bigger mess for the new administration, he added. Clyburn's office highlighted some major findings from the report: that vaccine distribution under President Donald Trump fell short of expectations, as well as his administration's failure to address critical gaps in the medical supply chain or fraudulent activity related to corporate relief programs. Implementation of GAO's recommendation concerning the importance of clear and comprehensive vaccine distribution and communication plans remains a work in progress, the report says. Moreover, slow implementation of GAO's recommendations relating to program integrity, in particular those made to the Small Business Administration and Department of Labor, creates risk of considerable improper payments, including those related to fraud, and falls far short of transparency and accountability expectations. The report urges the new Democrat-controlled Congress and administration to act on not only the previously ignored recommendations, but also 13 new ones. GAO is pleased that the Consolidated Appropriations Act 2021, enacted in December of 2020, requires a number of actions that are consistent with several of GAO's prior recommendations, including those related to the medical supply chain, vaccines and therapeutics, and COVID-19 testing, the agency adds. GAO will monitor the implementation of the Act's requirements. Thompson expressed hope that the new president will, as he promised on the campaign trail, pursue a more effective COVID-19 agenda. It's tragic. It will take a year and over 400,000 American lives lost for the federal government to take substantive action to take this pandemic seriously.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters. Thank you for joining us on today's episode of The Lantern. We're here with you from IRRB English Radio. Thank you for tuning in. There's a very interesting hadith from Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam. His Eminence was asked regarding love. This subject is in any way included in the context of religion. And the answer that Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam gave, I think it could be set as a life mantra for all of us. When asked about love in religion, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam said, "Is religion anything but love?" Let's listen to a story and create some tangibility regarding this subject in our minds. And we will continue with our discussion in a short bit. Stay with us. traveling faster than messenger. Once Ayaz, the favorite slave of Mahmud, the king, became ill due to the evil eye of courtiers who always envied Sultan Mahmud's favors upon him. Ayaz could not come to the court because of illness as he was bedridden. When the news of his illness reached Sultan Mahmud, he called for his most loyal messenger to take the fastest horse and rush to Ayaz. Although I'm far away from you, but in reality my soul is next to you. I have not forgotten about you, and your suffering is my own suffering, Sultan wrote in a message. Sultan ordered the messenger not to stop anywhere and avoid any delays. The messenger rode over the fastest possible horse without any breaks, but once he reached Ayaz, he was shocked to see that the Emperor Mahmud was already there at his bedside. The messenger shivered with fear since he thought the Emperor will suspect that he disobeyed his order and took a rest during the journey. "Do not worry," replied Sultan, seeing messenger's facial expression. "I know you did not take rest, but how can anyone travel faster than one whose heart is captured by his beloved?"
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
There's a hadith Qudsi, and in it Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala basically describes the process of the love which is exchanged between him and his subject, his creation. And he talks about how when someone gets to know God and they gain ma'rifah and knowledge toward what Allah is, once we gain a certain level of ma'rifah toward him, we can't help but to love him. And the reason is, one of the reasons is that to love perfection and to love things that are good is our innate and inborn quality. It is the reason why we strive for the best in life. It is the reason why we aim to accomplish so much. It is the reason why we struggle and strive in our lives to achieve monumental things and to reach higher degrees of education and be successful in our career and try to land that promotion or that gig or raise good children or even be beautiful. It is because we have an inborn and innate drive, attraction toward things that are beautiful, that are good, that are complete. And obviously Allah is the collection. He's the source. He's the origin of all things that are at their highest peak of perfection. Only Him, no one else. So basically, by putting that inborn love for perfection within us, He is equipping us with the ability to find Him in our lives. When we have that sort of yearning in us, and it is close to impossible to satiate it with the limited resources this world has, we then find the longing to head toward a more fulfilling, more meaningful, more lasting manifestation of that perfection, of that completion, of that completeness. And that will inspire within us to find a Creator who is all-wise, all-kind, merciful, compassionate, and able. So basically, in this hadith, Allah continues saying that once a person's find ma'rifah and knowledge toward me, they can't help but to love me. And once they love me, the term used in this hadith is ishq.
And I don't think there's an equivalent for that Arabic word in the English language. It's something higher than love. It is more of an obsession. Ishq is the little vine plant that wraps around a tree and then sucks the very life out of it, rendering that tree hollow and lifeless. When someone has ishq towards something or someone else, they allow that obsession to consume them, to eat them up, to empty them from any notion of meanness, of ego, of self-centeredness, of selfishness. So when someone loves Allah, they become obsessed with Him. And once they become obsessed with Him, Allah will love them in return. And when Allah loves them and Allah has ishq toward them, when Allah empties them from themselves, He takes their life. The story that we heard was about a sultan who loved one of his servers for whatever the reason. Maybe that server had done a great act of kindness toward that sultan. Maybe that server had helped him in his times of need, had comforted him, had supported him, had given him the attention that he always yearned for throughout his life. But he never genuinely got it from anyone. Maybe that server was really sincere. But in any case, that server had done something for the sultan to love him so much. In the case of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, there is nothing that He needs from us. There is nothing that we can do for Him. There is no favor. There is no act of selflessness that we can do for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for Him to be indebted to us. Whatever we do it for ourselves and for our yearning toward perfection and completion, our yearning toward having eternal existence. But Allah is so beneficent, He's so benevolent, He's so kind, so magnanimously generous toward us, that even that act of goodness we do for our own salvation, He takes it personally. He takes it to heart, as if, and He compensates for us in return, and He rewards it with His love. And it is that love that Allah gives, that love that limitless, eternal entity, which is the God of heaven and earth, which is given to us, that grants us that eternal life, that sense of completion that we always needed. This topic of love of Allah is something that we can talk about for years, but unfortunately that's all the time we have for today's episode of The Lantern. Thank you so very much for tuning in. Until another greeting, we leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
ألا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.